You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, my beautiful people. Thank you for tuning in. Merry Christmas to you. Today, what I thought we'd do is round up the questions that I asked of guests in the past and turn them on myself, which probably isn't fair because I've had time to think about my answers. But in my defense, all a guest had to do was listen to a previous episode and they would have known what was coming. Tell you what, let's save the Q&A for the end, and I'll start with politics and business. Since it's Christmas Eve, I thought this article was appropriate to discuss. It says, this is according to Axios, Democrats are five times more likely than Republicans and independents to reduce time with family due to political differences. And one of the ways that they would reduce time with family is by not inviting them over for the holidays. That's quite surprising, said nobody who lives in America. You know what this reminds me of? You know how they say everybody's a little racist, or at least partial to their own race, but that the prejudice ends at the point when somebody else opens their mouth? Prejudice means to prejudge, of course. So the argument is that people are going to prejudge you until they're able to actually judge you. And the prejudging ends when you start talking. It's like the jazz musician. What was his name? Daryl Davis. He, by just interacting with members of the Ku Klux Klan, had convinced 200 of them to leave the KKK. It's pretty powerful. Something similar happens when Democrats actually interact with an independent or a Republican. It's like, wait a minute, this is a good, genuine person. But most of them won't do that. For the same reason, followers of other religions won't entertain other perspectives, because it may have them questioning their long-cherished beliefs and upset their worldview. It takes a really strong character to even entertain the possibility that you could be wrong, and it takes an even stronger character to process information that is contrary to your beliefs, see how it makes sense, and then change your mind. People don't like changing their mind. It's always easier to convince somebody of a lie than to convince them after the fact that they've been lied to, right? But character isn't something we talk about much in America anymore. I had a buddy gift me a book last week. It is called Government Gangsters by Kash Patel. Thank you, Dano. It's a fascinating read. The subtitle is The Deep State, The Truth, and the Battle for Our Democracy. This was interesting. I saw where Byron York posted on X that anti-Trump types criticized the Kash Patel FBI nomination. They're worried Patel will use the Bureau to target Trump's political enemies. The FBI targeting political enemies, he says? Imagine that. Where were these critics in 2016, 2017, and beyond? Then somebody comments saying, you're cheering a descent into Banana Republic territory by saying the other guy did it first. And then York says that nightmare scenario whereby under Director Patel, the FBI would, and then he lists what the FBI might do under Patel, and you can see if this sounds familiar, open investigations on presidential candidates, deploy undercover agents and confidential sources to spy on a candidate's advisors, hire a campaign opposition researcher under the guise of intelligence gathering, present false opposition research to a court as a basis for wiretapping a candidate's advisor, use false opposition research to brief the President of the United States, ambush the President-elect with false opposition research, seek to include false opposition research in intelligence community products, ambush the National Security Advisor with wiretap information on the pretense of a Logan Act violation, mislead or stonewall Congress on the investigation of the President, mislead the President about the investigation targeting him. And then he says, can you imagine the FBI doing something like that? Of course, he's saying that sarcastically. What I will say, and I think I speak for all reasonable people, regardless of political affiliation, is that we don't want lawfare. When you hear Dems talking about fear of retribution, that is a tell. Because had you done nothing wrong, you wouldn't use the word retribution. Am I right? So by all means, prosecute those guilty of corruption who've broken the law. But we don't want the death spiral that America was on. We're trying to put a stop to that. And using lawfare to put your political opponents in jail every time you have a change in power, that would be the end of us. So I'm glad to see so many reasonable people with common sense assume positions of power. It truly feels like power is returning to where it belongs, which is in the hands of the people, the hands of us, rather than unelected bureaucrats. This was on full display last week with the omnibus continuing resolution bill. You had a genius level intellect say that he was going to read the 1,500-page bill and then post what he thought was ridiculous. This is Vivek Ramaswamy I'm talking about. And he did, and the X community started speaking up, and the bill was effectively destroyed. It was killed. Democracy in action. You know, they're saying that bills filled with pork may become a thing of the past, not just because you have very smart and committed citizens who are going to read the bill before it's passed, but with AI, they should be able to quickly summarize the bill and then highlight the BS for all to see. They're even suggesting those who propose pork should have their name attached to the pork so everybody would know what kind of crap they're trying to get us to spend money on. So AI maybe is going to save the republic and then destroy us later. Who knows? I know you know this, but all government spending is a tax on us. Inflation being the most insidious form of taxation. I remember in 2009, when we were going through the recession, when Obama passed his massive spending bill, it was a little over $800 billion. And I believe he called it the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Everybody was concerned it would lead to massive inflation, but it didn't. And so I feel like when Biden took office, they thought they could spend their ass off and not have to worry about inflation. So he wasn't in office but 2 months before the infrastructure bill was passed, and that cost $2.3 trillion. Then a year later came the Inflation Reduction Act, which, of course, Biden later admitted, I think it was September 23, that he said, yeah, that bill had nothing to do with reducing inflation. So bills are named by the opposite of the result that's coming. See Patriot Act or Affordable Care Act. The Biden administration was not worried about the middle class paying more taxes anyway. And I use inflation interchangeably here with tax because inflation is a tax. If the last 4 years taught us anything, it's that the average everyday American or the middle class, which I guess is another word for everyday American, you can use them interchangeably, middle class, everyday American. I don't think the lives of everyday Americans was in their top 10 of concerns. It probably wasn't in their top 50 concerns. I don't know. You be the judge. But do you know why politicians refer to the middle class at all? It's because something like 95% of Americans believe themselves to be in the middle class. But you know what would have concerned the Biden administration is if it impacted their reelection chances, all the inflation. But they had a plan for that, which I alluded to a minute ago. They were going to use the courts. And if that doesn't work, you want to take the other guy out by any means possible. Do you wonder if that Thomas Crook fella, if he had been successful, would we know any more about him today? How scary is it now for normies to realize how many of those living among us are okay with killing people? After that assassination attempt, I want to say, I mean, we'd have to estimate, but what, 10% of the country wish that Trump hadn't turned his head? And then you have this dreamy-looking coward guy who shot a healthcare CEO in the back, and something like 41% of people aged 18 to 29 say that the murder was justified. 41%. 2 out of 5 young people in their 20s. When I was learning about World War II, something that really stood out to me was the amount of civilians, just regular people, who were willing to commit the most heinous crimes, including murder. It was somewhere around 200,000 Austrians who basically joined forces with the Nazis to do terrible things. And when they were studied after the fact, they found no more sociopaths per capita in that part of Europe than they did anywhere else in the world. So here in America, there's something like 4% of the population they believe to be sociopaths. What is that, 1 in 20? And in prisons, it's closer to 20 to 25%. I think because I'd read up on history, whether it be the Nazi Germany or the Soviet gulags, and knowing all those atrocities were committed by humans, which we happen to be, I think for that reason, none of these people revealing themselves as evil surprises me. They've always been among us. There just wasn't an easy way for people to advertise that they were, in fact, a piece of shit. But here we are. If you didn't think a large swath of the population would have you rounded up and put in a cage for the rest of your life due to your political beliefs, you are naive no longer, hopefully. Although they do say with communism that a lot of people won't realize the purge is happening until the boot is actually on their neck. And I think that's right. I think, unfortunately, many people are incapable of understanding what's happening until they have firsthand experience with it. That's why they can't learn from others' mistakes. They've got to experience it for themselves. And we see little microcosm examples of this all the time. Like when somebody says, well, you don't know what you would do until you're in that situation. The hell I don't. I know me. Just the other day, I had a buddy tell me, he told me exactly this. He said, and I don't remember what we were talking about, but he said, you know, you can't know what you would do if somebody threw a grenade into your foxhole to blow up the team. You might say you jump on it, but really, would you? And I'm like, yes. Assuming I love these guys and they were like my brothers, of course I'd jump on that grenade 100% of the time because I know me. And he's saying you can't know if you've never been in that situation, but I think you can. Because I've been in situations like that, not exactly like that, of course, but I know the feelings that are conjured up when you experience something on a lesser scale, something that might be anxiety-inducing for most people. And if you're in a position to save your family or guys that you like a brother, I believe you know how you would conduct yourself in those situations, whether you would freeze up, whether you could control your emotions, whether you could harness those emotions to act in a way that's in accordance with your values. It's all practice. I mean, you've been living according to your values your entire life. Why would you just abandon those when something serious happened? I believe you can get a glimpse of how it would feel in these situations, and then you just need to see a little further to imagine how you'd feel in a more serious scenario. Like you've had a small sampling of something going seriously wrong, and you see beyond it to know how you'd react if the dial were turned up. I don't think that's hard to comprehend. I mean, I think people can understand that. It's like when you're watching Dateline and somebody says, someone who just killed their wife wouldn't act like that. Or even, man, this tastes like shit. In both instances, somebody will say, well, how do you know? Well, I don't think you can 100% know how somebody should act following the murder of their spouse. But just like in lie detection, which you can never be 100% sure of, I think you can get pretty damn close, especially if you work at it and you get to where maybe you're right 80 to 90% of the time. An NPC doesn't stand a chance at any of this, just so you know. And then, of course, tasting like shit, you're going by smell, right? If it smells like shit, it probably tastes like shit. My last article about journeying into language learning might be worth a read if you're interested in how I think about learning a second language. In summary, it's a struggle, but it's worth it. I also talk about our recent getaway to Mexico, why it's better to start learning a second language when you're young. And I talk about effective methods that I've used to learn Spanish faster and retain more of what I've learned. Also, I realize none of you are receiving my emails when something new is published, and I got bad news on that. During my hiatus of about 8 months, the email service I'd been using lost everything. And the blog's inception was September 2017. So 7 years of readers and listeners gone. The service I used was called Mailer Light, if you're curious. They decided to throw me a curveball and change the way they do their email distribution. And unlike me, they didn't leave it hanging. that curveball didn't last in the zone long. They had a deadline for moving everything over, and I missed it. Well, I didn't even swing and miss. I took it right down the poo-poo for a called third strike, and I'm out. So that sucks. You can find me walking back to the dugout with less fans. And some of them were cheering, too. Yeah, I'm going to miss that. Even when I'd strike out, they would cheer. And sure, there were boos, but the key is not to dwell on the boos. You want to use the naysayers as fuel, right? Boos are good. There's nothing better than hecklers in the stands. Unless you're trying to speak and they shout you down, I guess. But how somebody could be bothered by a heckler when they're playing a sport is beyond me. Because you've got to know that they wouldn't pay attention to you if you weren't any good. Then you also know that dude heckling you would love to be where you are, playing in the arena, so to speak, rather than drinking beer in the stands. He can do that the rest of his life. But a young man in his 20s, trust me, he'd rather be where you are. So welcome the critics. Some people are going to love you. You know what they say is the opposite of love? Many think it's hate. It is not hate. The opposite of love is indifference. So welcome the love and the hate. What you don't want is indifference. Let me tell you this story. By the way, I know I tell a lot of stories, but I like to think that I wouldn't share a story unless there was something to be gleaned from it, something of value, something that could be a benefit to you. So unless there was some value to be extracted, I don't think I'd make the effort to tell so many stories. Ask my friends. Most of the stories I share here, they've never heard. So I'm working with this young man who was beat down because he'd been rejected recently. He had lost a sizable deal that he expected would close by the end of the year. And he spent a lot of time prepping and getting everything together, got others in the organization involved, because as a young business person, you never want to lose a deal alone. No, you want to get others involved who can help you. That's why I always say it's just as important that you sell internally as well as externally. If you're taking customers to lunch every week, don't neglect those who help you at the office. They are just as critical to your success. So my guy and I, we talked right after he'd gotten this rejection, and he was really bummed out, like real down in the dumps. And I commiserated with him a bit. I can surely relate to deals that are on the one-yard line that fall through. It'd be like him telling me about a breakup. Like, yeah, buddy, I've been there. We'll get through it. But after you process the negative emotions you're experiencing, which I think you should do, by the way, even if you have to give yourself a deadline, like I will sulk until 8 a.m. tomorrow, and then it's time to get back on the horse. And at that time, what I'm going to do is examine every aspect of the sales cycle to see what went well and what didn't go well. Could I have done a better job qualifying this prospect? What angles didn't I consider? Speaking of angles you may not have considered, as a young salesperson or investor or probably just any sort of business person, a lot of times you'll take more rejections just because you don't have that much experience. And I'm usually not big on experience. I'll tell you why in a minute. But where a lack of experience might come into play is when you hear an objection that you hadn't ever encountered before. And although you may have known it was a possibility until you experience it firsthand, it doesn't stick with you. It's kind of what I talked about earlier, but in a different context. But just as an example, let's look at the questions I just mentioned. What went well? Well, maybe you did a great job determining who the decision makers are. You turned one of them into your champion. A champion is someone in the account you're targeting who's going to help you sell the product. They're basically going to sell the product or service on your behalf. So you built great rapport. That went well. But could you have done a better job qualifying the deal? There was that one dude who came from a company that used your competitor's product and loved it. You heard rumors about that dude, but you never really followed up with him. Didn't think he was important enough. Didn't research his background and get to know him a little bit. But he had a bigger say than you knew. Well, that's a fail. Another mistake I see young people make is not finding out who you're competing with. Who else are they looking at? What are their thoughts on your competitors? What experience do you have using a product or service like the one I'm offering? What did they do well? What could they have done? From a functionality standpoint, is there anything that could have been improved? or from a customer service standpoint, what would have made your life easier? And I think many of the qualifying questions don't get asked because the reps don't want to know the answer. They prefer to hold on to hope instead. But we know if hope is your strategy, even if they do buy, they're going to be looking for change soon enough. Just ask Obama. The way my brain works when I face rejection, or really failure of any kind, is to first process the emotions. I don't suppress them. I don't block them out. I allow myself to feel the blues. And that's the breaks, y'all. Then you let a little of that bass groove right here. You just got to keep on keeping on. Start doing the Humpty dance before you even feel like it. It's hard to feel unhappy when you're dancing. Same thing with smiling. If you can force a smile upon your face, your mood will improve. But when I'm done dancing, I immediately want to put every detail of the deal under truthful examination and look at what I did right, what I didn't do right, where could I have done a better job qualifying the prospect. As I said, did I consider all the angles? I mean, when I was selling real estate full-time, I would do listing presentations and equip the prospective client with basically everything they would need to if they wanted to do it themselves. The comparative market analysis, so they know what to sell it for, how long they could expect it to take before they were under contract, how to market the property. And if they wanted the hassle of it, they could just give it a go without me. Well, it happened on more than one occasion where they would take the info I gave them and then list their house themselves using For Sale by Owner or one of those websites. Here's what I told my client to do as part of coaching. I said, what I would do is have a third party, maybe your boss or even a colleague, call into the account to get candid feedback. That is going to be invaluable to your development and make you more effective going forward. Something I see all the time in sales organizations are reps who hold on to hope as a strategy. So they'll tell the higher-ups that the deal has an 80% chance of closing, or it's on the one-yard line, and then a higher-up inserts himself or herself, because you never want to lose a deal alone. He gets involved in the deal, only to find out it's actually got a 10% chance of closing. Or worse, he's doing the post-mortem and discovers the deal didn't have a chance to begin with. The sales rep was just fluffing the pipeline. To me, it seems it's like the sales rep made a calculation that it's better to forecast a deal as likely to close, or sometimes even just keep the deal hanging around. And the calculation being that management will think more of them for having more prospective deals. And what happens is they struggle to be objective. They've spent so much time working on the deal that they're They spent so much time working the deal that, well, they basically become married to it, and a breakup would hurt too much. Some people are the same way with stocks. They smoke opium with a bogus pipeline. You see what I did there? They're not able to view their deals objectively. They get attached to them the same way investors can get attached to certain stocks or investments that they've had a while, which you should never do, by the way. This may be helpful. So I find myself telling single guys quite a bit when they face rejection. I tell them not to dwell on it. And I know that's easier said than done, but you want to find ways to get through it. Read Who Moved My Cheese, for example. That's a good book when you're going through either girlfriend change or job change or just any sort of big change in your life. But the reason you don't want to dwell on rejection is because it's a waste of time when you could be finding more cheese. And the reason it's a waste of time is it doesn't matter if it's a breakup or you lost $1 million deal or you didn't get the job you want. There could be 8 million reasons or let's say there could be 8 million possibilities as to why you didn't get the girl or didn't get the deal or the job you wanted. And in all likelihood, you will never know which of those 8 million possibilities is the real reason you didn't close the deal. So why spend time brooding over it? Oh, so the reason I'm not big on experience. Whether someone has 5 years experience or 17 years experience, we've all worked with people who have way more experience than we do, but they're not smart or their work ethic sucks. You know, lack of experience is mostly just something an employer tries to use to not pay you. Well, I can't pay you that. You've only got 7 years experience. It's a negotiating gambit. No different than when they tell you, I want somebody who really wants the job. By the way, your rebuttal there is, I understand, and I want this job real bad, but I also want to work for somebody who really wants to pay me what I'm worth. But yeah, feedback is interesting. I find young people aren't getting enough constructive feedback, I guess, due to sensitivities that they have. They don't want honesty. Like I said, it's hard to change your mind, especially when it upsets your worldview. You may have heard me say this before. Like, people say that they really like picking up what you're putting down. And then you get that one a-hole whose name is like Future Trans 5000. And he's from one of the boroughs in New York with green hair, doesn't show his face. And they, which is a pronoun, they interpret what you've said in the least generous way possible. And you can't help but think about that one piece of negative feedback versus the other 99 whose feedback was good. You know what I've always said, though? Like, when people are struggling with something that's weighing them down a little bit, I ask this question. I say, what if you couldn't control your thoughts? And you know what they say? Well, can you? And it prompts a discussion. You know, they say the height of wisdom is the ability to take your own advice. So I remind myself of these things. Think about the implication of the question, what if you couldn't control your thoughts? Since we know in life there's nothing that'll harm us more than our own thoughts, it's really helpful to remind yourself that you can get better at controlling your thoughts. And if you're not good at it, it's also wonderful to know that it's something you can work on diligently daily, make it a habit, and you'll get better at controlling your thoughts. And emotions, for that matter. Emotions are much easier to control when you can gently push negative thoughts out of your mind. So the question is designed to make you think. I mean, how miserable would life be if you had absolutely no control over your thoughts? Think of the horror. I mean, that would be a mini hell on earth. But fortunately, God gave us the ability to control our directing mind, for those who desire to develop the ability. And the best tools I know are prayer and meditation. You know, I went to Catholic school my first 9 years of schooling. And one thing they didn't teach, which I think is a mistake, or maybe this was taught in the higher grade levels, I'm not sure. But I don't think so. Because I had a buddy who went to a Catholic retreat for men recently. And, well, I actually have quite a few friends that have done these retreats every year, and they love it. But I asked one of them, what do they do on these retreats? And he said the first thing they learn is how to pray. And I'm like, how to pray? I've been praying all my life. Have I been doing it wrong? But I imagine there are different forms of prayer that I reckon I just haven't been exposed to. In the same way, I didn't realize for a long time that there are different methods to meditate. So the only type of meditation I've ever done is TM, or Transcendental Meditation. And I've prayed pretty much the same way my entire life, either reciting a prayer in my head or giving thanks and praise, praying for those who need it way more than I do. Well, there's more to it than that, now that I think about it. Praying for the souls of those we've lost, or sometimes just having a conversation, albeit a one-way conversation most of the time. If God wants to tell me something, he'll generally do it through others. Somebody he's put into my life for a reason. That's what I believe anyway. But what I'm getting at is this. There is a massive benefit to prayer that nobody talks about, at least not around me. But it's that meditation is a natural part of prayer, in that when you're in prayer, your mind can start to wander. And I'm sure this happens to you. I mean, it happens to me all the time. But again, I never hear anybody talk about it. And that's what TM is all about, training your mind to observe without judgment the thoughts that come and go. And when these thoughts are stubborn and they hang around, you can learn to gently nudge them, to push them out of your mind, as if it's just a passing cloud in the sky. And when you can have a laugh at your thoughts' expense, if you can do that, you are really ahead of the game. And it's this controlling of your mind that you want to achieve if you wish to be as grateful and contented as possible. So when you're in prayer and your mind starts to wander, just acknowledging that your attention has floated off into the ether, something you don't want to be thinking about, and then pulling that attention back to prayer, that is training your brain. And I think prayerful people benefit from doing this, probably without realizing it. It goes left unsaid for whatever reason. Whereas with TM, it's well understood that your regular meditation practice is going to benefit you in everyday life. Well, prayer can do the same. But I could be wrong on some of this. I mean, it's possible, you know, maybe I was taught about training your mind through prayer and just wasn't paying attention that day. That is very possible. I don't think my mind's ever wandered more than when I was a second grader sitting in class as a kid. I'm sure I missed a lot. But going back to losing my email list, you know, I've been kind of torn. I want more readers and listeners or even followers. But I'm torn because I've always said I don't want to be famous. And of course, there's no guarantee that I would be. I don't harbor illusions of grandeur. But I do know that you run that risk if your platform were to blow up, if it were to get big. And where I'm torn is, while my ultimate goal is to help people, you obviously can't help anyone in isolation. But two, what I wanted all along was a small group of high character guys who wanted to do better. And I feel like I've got that. And one of the hallmarks of the good life is knowing when to be contented. But then as a man who enjoys building and creating things, I have something that I could grow, which is thrilling, right? Seeing something you've created take off. So that's my dilemma. It's a good problem to have, I guess, but I haven't invested significant time or resources to grow my audience. But I may someday. The email service sent an email when I was going through the worst of my struggles early this year, and they wanted you to upload your email to this new system that they started using. Well, when that email went out, I was in no shape to be doing much of anything. Even if I had seen it, I would have probably forwarded it to my assistant to take care of. My assistant is a total stud. Where you at, Sats? By the way, if you need a virtual assistant, or a VA as they're referred to now, let me know. I should be able to refer you somebody who speaks English very well and is willing to work hard. There's not a much better feeling than waking up in the morning and seeing a few completed tasks that you requested the night before. The reason it works that way is my VA is 14 hours ahead. So it's already Thursday there by the time we get to 10 a.m. on Wednesday. But unfortunately, when you're incapacitated, as I was, entropy lays its claim on your life. Like, there were quite a few things I had to let slip while I was out of it. This is mostly January, February of 24, which isn't like me to just let things fall by the wayside, but there were only so many things I could do, so many things I could get the wife to help me with. So things had to go on the back burner. And one of the biggest ones, which really gets to me, is I had planned to do a retreat overseas with my guys, the guys I coach. I had picked out the place and everything. I was so looking forward to spending time with those dudes, some of whom I haven't met yet. It was going to be one of those iron sharpens iron retreats, because I know how much these guys would benefit just from being around each other for a few days and nights. And I had planned to have each of the guys on the podcast because their stories are inspiring and I get a front row seat to it all, sometimes feeling like Lou Gehrig. I also wanted to give them the opportunity to give a presentation to the group so that they could practice their public speaking skills, which would force them to teach the rest of us something and get that oh-so-critical constructive feedback. Because so many young people are not seeking constructive criticism. And sadly, those who might be willing to give feedback are hesitant to do so because everybody's afraid of offending everybody. And to that, I would say, if you're unwilling to receive constructive criticism or honest feedback about your performance, whether it's at work, giving a presentation, or at home, or on the pickleball court, basically anywhere, if you don't seek feedback from your managers and coaches, sometimes even your peers, you will never come close to fulfilling your potential. Not even close. because you want to know what you don't know. And I say this a lot, but the most valuable thing in life that you could possibly study is yourself. So help others help you, elicit feedback, and accept it graciously, and see if you can't make some adjustments or improvements to your life, which should also improve the lives of those around you. There's a former university professor named Diane Fleischman. She's now an evolutionary psychologist. And she said this recently. She said, reintroducing oral exams would not only prevent students from writing essays with large language models, or LLMs, but also foster a more valuable skill for the real world than essay writing, convincing people you know what you're talking about. When she was teaching, she said fellow faculty members would complain that some students never spoke up in class. So she proposed that your grade in the class could be determined, at least in part, based on class participation. But the other professors said that the policy proposal wasn't fair to everyone, of course, right? Those who suffer from social anxieties or are more introverted, it was unfair to them, is what they said. More on that in a minute. One of the guys I coach asked me last week how I deal with blind spots in my awareness, which is such a great question. And it probably may have prompted the thought today, now that I think about it. But what I said is, first, I don't think it's something you can do on your own, learn your blind spots. I believe you have to seek feedback from others, preferably somebody who knows you well. And I gave him this example. I said about 15 years ago, I asked my best buds questions like, why do you think people like me? And that may sound corny or even presumptuous, what makes me think that people like me at all. But we could all do this because I guarantee you somebody is fond of you. And probably your friends are. But be forewarned, if you start asking questions about yourself like this, you're going to be made fun of. At least I was. Because my friends and I were used to giving each other shit all the time. Remember, guys insult each other but don't mean it, and women do the same, except they do it using compliments instead of insults. So what'll happen is your friends, if they're anything like mine, they'll give you the BS answer first, making fun of you, essentially. Just like Hollywood Squares. You remember that show where contestants would call on somebody to ask a question, and then they'd give an answer that was obviously wrong? Or a joke, they were trying to be funny, and then they'd give their real answer. That's how it's going to go, more than likely. You just have to say something like, I know, I'm so gay, just sorry I asked. But seriously, if you had to pinpoint one thing that I could improve, or this is a good one too, tell me about that one time I pissed you off. A friend who is willing to give you that sort of feedback, so incredibly valuable to developing your personality. And that's a phrase you don't hear often, which, hell, I never hear it, developing your personality. And I think this is something most people don't think about or even think is possible. They think, well, my dad was this way, or I'm just like my grandpa. Well, that may be so, but it's also true you can change your habits. You can go from being more introverted to extroverted, from pulling all-nighters to suddenly becoming a morning person. You could go from somebody who never thought to write a personal note to somebody to someone who has a regular practice of doing that. There are aspects of you that are malleable. And what you do habitually can't help but to change your personality, likely for the better if you incorporate some of what I just mentioned. Like if you had a goal to write 5 handwritten notes every day, you think that wouldn't change your personality? If you did 5 notes, personal notes per week, I can almost promise you it would change you. Okay, let's get to some of the questions that I used to ask on the podcast. Starting from the top, is not wanting something just as good as having it? The answer I liked most, by guess, is it depends, because that's what I think. I'd also put a timeline on having that thing. Like if you don't have any desire to own a 4,000 square foot house with a pool, I can see where it'd be psychologically beneficial to reconcile in your mind that not wanting that house with the pool is just as good as having it. But those first few weeks or even months of having it would be hard to compete with. And this could be true whether you don't want the girl because you let's say you know long term, she'd be dreadful or wouldn't know how to respect you. But you might want to go through the honeymoon phase with her, or the rabbit phase, whatever you want to call it. I heard J-Lo one time say that she got married so much because she believed that she was addicted to falling in love. The same would apply to just about anything. You can get the new McMansion and feel like a pimp for a while, or you get the swimming pool and you swim in it 40 times that first summer. Then in subsequent years, you might get in there once a month. I'm one who likes to break down big purchases like that down to cost per usage. So you put in a $100,000 pool and then realize over the next 7 years, you've only used it 100 times. Well, that's a cost of $1,000 for each time you took a dip. And when I dip, you dip, we dip, you know, so we can get our cost per usage down. And you can do this with clothes. And that's where I tend to do it too. Like if you, let's say you go shopping at Lululemon, people poo-poo the cost, but the quality of their threads is pretty high. So while you might pay $60 for shorts, and that seems exorbitant, if you can get 200 wears out of them over the next 5 years, that's only, what, 30 cents a wear? And I've had situations where I have brought shorts back to Lululemon after 5 years and they replaced them at no cost because they had a little hole in the crotch. Versus the pair from Target that don't fit as well, and for that reason, you're unlikely to wear them as much. And when you do wear them, they deteriorate faster because of the lesser quality. So one of the reasons I really like this question, well, I like it for many reasons, which is why I asked, but people would come at the question is not wanting something just as good as having it from various angles. Like I remember one guy telling me it's good to want something because it can drive you, making you more productive as you strive toward what it is that you want. And therefore wanting something is better than having it. And I think that's a great answer too. There really was no right or wrong answer. It's just a question to get us all thinking and hearing different perspectives. I think we accomplished that. Next question, have you ever purchased an app on your phone? I have not, although I'm not opposed to it. I probably have. I pay for a subscription to X. I don't know if that counts or not. Probably not. I don't know. I think I meant paying for the app, like buying it for $2.99 or whatever. Number three, social media, net positive or net negative for society? This is another it depends question. I think it depends on how you use it. For me, it's overwhelmingly a net positive. I remember my cousin telling me back in 2010 that I was going to be so much smarter for never having gotten on Facebook. Well, I gave in November 2011 and I got on the Facebook app. So I'm sure my intelligence has suffered as a result. Although it was fortuitous timing that social media wasn't around for the most part when I was in my 20s. That time my eyes spent were, you know, the time my eyes were on social media was probably, or would have been on social media, was used to read books instead. But I'd certainly be here all day if I had to delineate all the good things that have come about by my being on social media. What stands out is the connections I've been able to make around the world. And I really enjoy seeing what's going on in other worlds, so to speak. Maybe that's my feminine side. Have you heard this before? The reason men get addicted to pornography is because men like to see naked women. Often two is better than one. But women tend not to have that problem because they're not so much into naked men. Now, what women do like is naked lives. So they get addicted. Like when I was a kid, it was soap operas and then it became reality TV. And now it's probably social media. Like if your mom is on Facebook, there's a very high likelihood she has looked at every last picture of you on there, probably read every single word you've ever typed. They want to get in there and see everything. But I guess the answer to this question would also depend on what phase of life you're in. Like in my bachelor days, I remember being discouraged that the app had suddenly become a kid's photo album. That was all my friends were posting, which was pictures of their kids. Well, now that I have my own, I don't mind it as much. If you were in high school, your social media experience would be totally different. With cyberbullying and AI nudes is the latest thing. They're swapping bodies on faces. I can't imagine a high schooler's experience would be a net positive. I mean, they could just live in the real world. They don't really need to be online. They can text each other to let each other know where the party's at. But social media is here to stay, so we may as well figure out the best way to use it so that it's a net positive in our lives instead of a net negative. Next question, and this question is apropos to me. If you could live anywhere in the world for 30 days, where would you go? I wouldn't want to risk going somewhere that I wasn't going to like. And I feel like in order to maximize my time somewhere, or at least make the most of my 30 days, if I went somewhere, yeah, I'd want to go somewhere that I already knew and loved. So fly me to Bali or Thailand. If I had to go to a city, it'd be Prague, with consideration given to Amsterdam. We actually looked into going to Amsterdam when we booked our Prague trip earlier this year, but it was so expensive. Not just more expensive than Prague, but way more expensive than Amsterdam has been historically. Way more. If you were in Final Jeopardy and got to choose the category, what would it be? Probably along the lines of what we're talking about, world geography, personal finance, your mom. I don't know. I can think of a bunch of categories I might choose, but it comes off kind of arrogant. Like, look at me. I think I know everything about all these things, but I wouldn't mind something to do with 80s movies or 90s music, World War II, continuing resolutions. Not really. Not that last one. All right, that's enough Q&A for today. I'll do more of these down the road. Let me close with kids say the darndest things. So we were leaving to go to a party the other day, and my little girl pulls out a pair of tennis shoes and puts them out for me and says, "Daddy, I put your Amazon shoes right here." And I'm like, "Amazon shoes? Why do you call them Amazon shoes?" And she said, "Oh, they have the check just like on the Amazon trucks." So she thought the swoosh was like the little arrow that they have on Amazon trucks. And so therefore, these were my Amazon shoes. Crazy. All right. Thank you for tuning in. I will chat back at you next time. I hope everybody has a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year if you don't hear from me.